Blog Talk Radio.
There, everybody. How's everyone doing tonight? Jerry, I got a question for you.
Okay, good. Shoot, man. I mean, you know, we got all night, you know?
Okay, what is this?
I like my town with a little drop of poison.
No. Okay,
Tom? Isn't that our boy Tom?
That's our boy Tom Waits, yes. That was our mystery movie song last show.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's why I was so excited after we ended the show. Okay.
The song is called...
All I do is listen to Tom, so yeah.
The song is called Little Drop of Poison. But the big mystery is, what movie is it from?
Now, that's a good question.
What movie was it used for? I don't know if it's from the movie.
No, but I always want to say a Jim Jarmusch movie, but I know that's probably...
You're close. You're close in that it's a... revered kind of auteur director.
Well, it's not Dracula, where is Renfield, so we know that. We can rule that one out.
Right. It is from a Wim Wenders film, The End of Violence.
Good movie.
Is it like a weight off your shoulders that you finally know that now?
Yeah, I mean, not that I won't be able to sleep any easier, but yeah.
I imagined I would help you out there.
You did. You did. You helped me out big time, man. So
we haven't done a show for about 10 days.
I know. 10 days it shook the world.
So what's been happening in your movie realm?
In my movie realm? I saw The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus on Saturday night. And, I liked it a lot. It's like classic Terry Gilliam. And it's eerie watching Heath Ledger because it's not like a Dark Knight in one sense because he has the makeup on. You're like really looking at Heath, and it's an eerie thing because a lot of the things he's saying are like really ironic in retrospect. And
right.
In hindsight, I mean, hindsight is probably the better word to use, but it's a wild film, and it's really a tour de force performance from Christopher Plummer.
I just saw a great interview with Christopher Plummer that Movie City News carried. The gentleman, David Poland, he's a really good interviewer.
Yeah,
and it was a nice, relaxed conversation with Christopher Plummer, and he couldn't have been warmer and more giving in his assessment of some of the movies in his career.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he hates...
Mike Wallace, man, you know?
He talked about Mike Wallace a lot, and he also discussed... His feelings about The Sound of Music, which in one sense, it gave him his name, his start in the business. Mm-hmm. In the other sense, it's a movie that he doesn't like. But he says it's a movie that is begging to be made fun of because it's just so wholesome.
That's funny, man. That's funny. I like that.
But I, you know, he's still doing it. He's playing Tolstoy in a new movie, The Station, The Last Station, I think is the name.
Yeah, that's getting a lot of like buzz too. That movie's getting a ton of buzz, Oscar buzz. So
yeah, he's still working a lot. He's still doing it. Here's the big question with Parnassus, though: is it seamless? Is the three additional actors taking over the role? Does that seem to fit? Like it almost could have been conceived that way to begin with.
Yeah, it does fit because it actually works out beautifully because each of them are like, I guess you could say, are defining aspects of Heath's personality. seen the film, especially the Colin Farrell performance, which is towards the end, is excellent. It's really good.
I like Colin Farrell more and more.
Yeah,
I like Colin Farrell more and more. He's doing great work.
Yes, he is. The first half is a little shaky. The first half is, I don't want to say, almost at times feels like a parody of a Terry Gilliam film, almost. It's like stuff on road that we've been down many times before. And that's good and it's bad. But once the film actually really gets going, it's pretty powerful stuff. Very interesting movie. And like I said, it's like Christopher Plummer is really, like, who holds the film together. Now, this film has not gotten rave reviews.
Right.
I've read a lot of nasty stuff about it over the since it's because I think it's come out in Europe first, and England and Ireland, and I have not read the kindest things about it. But it's,
well, critical division is pretty common with Terry Gilliam.
Look at Tideland was universally dismissed.
Right.
Some of the harshest reviews I've read of a film, and certainly did not deserve them. But you know, the only one I will say this: I actually think the partnership here, what's really sad, is the partnership between Ledger and Gilliam here is a lot tighter than it is in the than it was in the Brothers Grimm, which I still always felt like was a really like just sort of a so-so film, regardless of you know he's passing and everything. It's just not something I can say I really could ever get into. So you know, here you saw at least wow, you know, there was really something there between these two, and there was you know. There's not going to be that anymore. So.
Well, I think it's safe to say Heath Ledger hit his tide with the Brokeback Mountain, onto the Dark Knight, and finally with Dr. Parnassus.
Yeah.
I mean, he was
made a film. I want is it with Abby Cornish? Candy.
Candy, yeah.
That was excellent. I saw that a couple years ago, and I thought that was really good.
I've always admired Terry Gilliam. I'm not a big fan of fantasy.
I would never have known that. I'm shocked.
Yeah.
Unless
we're talking about adult cinema, but I've always admired Gilliam's vision, his tenacity, his determination. Because this is a guy where so many of his films are plagued with difficulty, with challenges, seemingly. Obstacles that are you can't overcome, and in some instances that's been the case with his La Macha project. This could have easily been that story as well with Parnassus.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
He takes a tragedy and creatively makes it work. It, also, as a kind of final tribute to the work of Heath Ledger. You know, the final thing he committed to film, he felt it was important enough for it to be seen to not just shelve the project completely.
No, and we're the luckier for it. And now, have you seen anything?
I saw 2012.
If that day, it made me want to go buy a Bentley immediately if I had the money.
Hey, did you go see it?
Yeah, we went to go see a midnight show of it. You know, dude, it's what I expected.
Oh my God, you saw that thing at midnight?
Yeah, dude. After
that
I was
thing was exhausting. That thing was exhausting when I watched it at 2 p.m.
You watched it at 2 p.m.? No, dude, it was like, I don't know, it's like, I mean, if the world's got to end, let this guy do it, you know? Unreal. I mean, you guys, he makes Michael Bay look like a choir boy in the sense of restraint.
Like a choir boy! That's like a Schwarzenegger in the days quote.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it is what it is. It was fun. I like the thought the first half. I mean, I've never seen him go so overboard with the special effects before. I mean, that was really, that scene in Los Angeles, that whole sequence.
Yeah,
it's just like you've got to be kidding me.
That is the high point. Let me the things that I liked about it. Let's take that route with it. This is funny because I really dislike Independence Day. I'm not a big fan of Day After Tomorrow, mainly because I don't like any of the people in his movies. I don't not the actors, but the characters. The characters I don't like.
Right.
This one had likable characters to me. I think John Cusack is essential for, as an anchor for that movie too.
Yeah, and Woody Harrelson and Amanda Peet.
Great.
And I like the Russian guy, the Russian boxer, the father. He was good. I liked him.
A real standout performance is the jazz musician opposite George Segal.
Yeah, he was great.
He is probably the best moment in the film, I think. But it, you know, it's eye popping for a little while. But
first
two and a half hours of it is just like being punched in the face. For you know, you feel bruised when you walk out, and not elated, not exhilarated, just exhausted.
Well, I liked it more than you, in the sense that it wasn't. See, all right, because I really don't do that much research before I go see a movie. Some of these movies. So I thought, oh, they're going into space. It's going to be like When Worlds Collide. I had no idea it was going to be like, oh, they're just going to be in the ocean. I was like, wait a second. Oh, shit, I really misread this one. They're going to stay. I thought they were going into space. So I was like, all right, that's a neat touch and everything. I didn't mind it. I liked it better than a lot of the other action, like, you know, sci-fi spectaculars this year. I got to say, though, I liked Independence Day out of the three of his end-of-the-world things the best, just because that was a rousing third act. There's nothing rousing here in the third act. Really.
It's depressing, isn't it? It's depressing because there is no way to reverse it. There is no hope. So it does play. Halfway through it, I was like, this movie is freaking depressing.
Yeah.
This isn't a fun movie for me. But so it's... They don't need to make another disaster movie again, I don't think
he can do, and I think he's done all he can do with this. What else can, I mean, except destroy the universe, maybe, but I mean, you know, he's just...
Well, here's the thing, man. We walked out, my brother said, I don't know if you know this, but he's in construction. So he said, a few years back, there was a concrete shortage. They were building this huge dam in China.
Yeah.
Supposedly. And that dam is not located on a map anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to be some kind of secret dam.
Right.
But there was a concrete shortage worldwide. Like, builders were getting really ticked off. And, and then you see on the news that they shot rockets to the moon and they found lots of water. And then you watch 2012.
It plays into a lot of that. Yeah, I mean...
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah,
big,
it does.
Big spaceships in a Chinese dam will take us up to the moon, where we can colonize and continue our race.
You continue and you destroy the moon while we're in the process. Destroy this one. But have you seen? Did you see anything else? I'm surprised you went to go see 2012. I did not think you would go see that, so I'm very interested.
No, I knew that it would be a big dumb movie, and I wanted
what it is—a big dumb fun. Well, I don't know if fun's the right word because you're right. You are exhausted when all is said and done. You're just like, oh God.
Yeah, but
one silver lining: the IRS will hopefully no longer exist after all the events.
And I didn't believe Danny Glover. I love Danny Glover. I didn't believe him as president. There's no way, with his suffering succotash lisp, that he could be president.
Wow, okay.
Is that cruel? Is that cruel?
That was cruel. And what does he have against the White House, that director? I mean, every film the White House is. New York was spared this time, though. New York, no destruction of New York was shown. At least not to my knowledge. That's true.
I wonder if there was a sensitivity about that.
Well, there wasn't for the day after tomorrow.
But if you think about disaster movies, and you look at Spielberg's War of the Worlds, which is a mixed bag for me, but it has moments of brilliance in it.
Oh, it does. I think the first half is utterly frightening and brilliant.
That's not a movie that you put your brain on hold. That actually has some kind of haunting resonance.
Oh yeah. The final thing where he's telling the guards, you know, the military guys, that whole sequence where he says no, because the birds are on the tripod, that they can tell the shields are off, and you know, he says no, look, you know, you got no, you know, fire, and I think that's a really good. I mean, I think Tim Robbins kills the movie when it's like that just slows down the movie. And I don't know if it ever recovers from that. I'm not sure. I mean, I understand why Tim Robbins is there. It's to ground it in the current events of the time. like the little, you know, it's like, you know, the whole thing, when he says occupations don't work,
right?
You know, that's why that's put in there for Iraq and whatever else you want to put in. I understand why that's there. I like War of the Worlds a lot. I know I'm in the minority there, but
yeah. Also saw a couple other things. I saw, well, we'll discuss, let's play this first interview and then we'll come back and discuss a couple
that
more.
Sounds like a good plan.
Also, we're going to end the show tonight, obviously. That's why I opened up with revealing our mystery movie song from last show, because we're going to close with another one, mm-hmm. which is probably a very simple one to guess, but I just want to give you a little teaser.
Okay.
Our first interview, Sebastian Gutierrez. Gutierrez. He is the writer-director of a new film called Women in Trouble, which is currently playing in select cities. It's a movie with a great cast. Carla Gugino, on and on and on. Josh Brolin is in this.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt's in it. And it's in, because he directed Carla Gugino in a short he made, Sparks, which is based on an Elmore Leonard story, short story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on, I think it's on the Killshot DVD, I'm not sure. But, yeah, so that's cool that they that's probably where they met, you know, and everything. So this movie
yeah.
sounds fascinating.
Well, he is actually, he's written big studio movies like Snakes on a Plane and Gothica and that kind of thing. So this is a real change of pace and for him, and a real personal project that he shot in 10 days. He just rustled up some money and shot it in 10 days. And he wanted to do a female ensemble that avoided the cliches of chick flick. So by all accounts, he's been very successful at it. So here, let me play a trailer for the film to give you guys a sense of what we're talking about. This is a little taste of the film Women in Trouble. This film, it's a terrific film, and it's a... Okay, that's not what I want to do. This is a little taste of the trailer for Women in Trouble.
That's as straight as it gets.
I'm pregnant.
Congratulations.
How can I be pregnant?
Are you a virgin?
No.
Then you can be pregnant.
You're kidding.
Can anyone hear me?
Hey, what's up?
Did you make the reservations or was I supposed to?
Oh, I'll take care of it.
You're on the other side of this door, aren't you, Addie? Ow! Oh, my God! Ow! You're gonna be all right.
She's fine. This happens to her all the time.
Really?
Very much like to carry on flirting with you after we land.
Is that right? Have you ever made a really bad mistake? One thing you can never forgive yourself for?
You can pick only one?
I'm serious.
Who's joking?
The way he looked at me, I could feel him mentally undressing me with his eyes.
Holly, we were working in a strip club.
You are alive, and the time is now. Today is the day you will not forget. One, two, three, four.
I want you to fall in love with me again.
I'm young, but I understand loneliness and how hard it can be.
Stupid, she
didn't
realize that I feel
for her. I'm not telling what fun and games the gods have in store.
What you've done before doesn't count. It's what you're going to do from now on.
If we don't tell people how we feel, what are we doing here?
Do you have baby boobs?
No.
You?
I'm only 13.
People start early these days.
Okay, that's the trailer to Women in Trouble, which is currently in limited release. Now here's our conversation with the writer-director of the film, Mr. Sebastian Gutierrez. This film, it's a terrific film, and it's a departure from some of the kind of the higher profile scripts that you've written in the past, like the Snakes on a Plane and Gothica and so forth. Obviously, you wrote those films; they're a part of you. But do you feel like a film like Women in Trouble is more along the lines of your sensibilities?
Yeah, 100%. Actually, this movie was sort of a reaction to those movies in that, you know, I'm very, very grateful for having written them, and I love the horror genre, but, you know, I came to a point where I just kept getting hired to do horror movies.
Yeah.
And I thought, wait a minute, I like all sorts of movies, and this is anybody that knows me knows that this is not quite me. So the idea was to make a very small movie that was a comedy that had to deal with women, and that was a much more character-driven story.
Yeah. Was it always a goal for you to eventually make a female ensemble film?
No, you know, I can't say that it was, but most movies that I've written, whether they've gotten produced or not, or that I've directed or just written, have had female protagonists. And I think, you know, it's a weird series of coincidences that Hollywood doesn't seem to have much use for female characters, and I've never quite understood that, because I've always felt like, well, the women, you know, they have, like, their emotions so much more accessible than men, so you can have a tough woman who the next second cries without having to explain anything, whereas if you have Russell Crowe, you have to explain why he's crying. And in a weird way, the only genre that you're allowed to have a female protagonist is the horror movie, where the female, in essence, acts like the male in the other movies, and the male then just plays the one-note girlfriend part, which is always tricky, by the way, in horror movies, because you always have a guy hanging around who needs to be rescued, but you can't quite do that. So it's a very awkward dynamic. So I can't say that I always thought in the back of my mind, one day I will write an ensemble of a movie about an ensemble of women. It just the origin of this movie was this scene that I found that I'd written a long time ago, this sort of 10-page dialogue scene with these two women getting ready to go out in front of a mirror, getting dressed. That the movie is played by Emmanuel Tricchi and Adrian Palicki. And I looked at the scene, I thought, this is kind of a cool scene, mostly dialogue, really easy to shoot. I could probably get a couple cameras and shoot this in one day and make a nice little short film. And then I thought, I could write 9 more of these 10-page segment dialogue-heavy scenes and interconnect them and make a whole movie. So that's sort of where the idea came from, and it just seemed like the starting point was these women in this situation, and I thought maybe, you know, they can be a bunch of different women in a situation of trouble, because I thought if I'm going to have a very talky 10 pages at a time, I have to get the stakes as high as I can possibly get them. So that's
And the screenplays, I mean, the through line is right there in the title, Women in Trouble, as you've just expressed. I'm interested in when you're writing characters, especially a film with as many characters as this one has, and it's true of men, female characters as well as male characters, how do you avoid writing types? Because these characters could easily fall into that category without your care in writing them. Is there a trick to that for you?
Right. I don't know that there is a trick. I wish I had the trick. If I knew the trick, I would even tell you. I think in the specific case of Women in Trouble, because the exercise was sort of how do I grab women who have different professions, try not to define them by their profession, even if the profession is, you know, porn star or call girl. And how do I see the human side on the other side of that?
Right.
I think it was very natural, you know, some of the stories in there are about mothers and daughters, and they talk in a specific way, and some of the stories that have to do with sex workers, probably the commonality between them is that, you know, these are people who, you know, used to being naked and having sex in front of strangers, might have very a nonchalant manner in which they deal with, you know, very raunchy dialogue, and that's funny. But their emotions are very real, so that's where it becomes a more universal thing. So it wasn't really, I think the situations are so exaggerated here that there wasn't that much of a trap of falling into people sounding similar to each other.
Right. But when you're directing, and I want to get into the length of time you had to shoot this film too, but when you're directing actors, this many actors, obviously all actors are different, they have different personalities. How do you direct an ensemble like this? Do you have the same approach with everyone, or do you approach them differently according to their specific needs?
Definitely approach them differently. I mean, what's funny is, of course, anytime you direct an ensemble, it's tricky. When it's all women, you might as well just give up from the get-go and say, I'm not really making any decisions here. I'm just going to try and move the pieces around and make sure I don't, you know,
right.
I don't get in the way of some serious damage. Because of the way the movie was made in such a short amount of time, it was shot in 12 days, basically what it meant was that every day we were shooting like a mini movie starring two or three actors. You know, so if we were doing a sequence on the airplane, we had Josh Brolin, Marlee Shelton, and Garcelle Bavaud. That was the mini movie being made that day. If we were doing a scene with Carla Gugino and Connie Britton stuck in an elevator, that's the mini movie we were doing that day. So in a funny kind of way, that helps separate everything to keep things in a very straight fashion. It's like we're doing this movie today, tomorrow we're doing that movie.
Right.
As to different methods of working with different actors, yeah, I mean, I do think that's one of the most interesting things about directing is that you have to be sort of a frustrated many things. You have to be a bit of a frustrated actor and a frustrated writer and a frustrated photographer and a frustrated psychologist, you know. So obviously different actors operate in different ways. The main thing here was that everybody needed to know their dialogue going in, and it was big chunks of dialogue. And
right.
So you come across some people who are more used to TV, who are used to improvising lines, and then it was a matter of saying, that's not going to work because you're setting up very specific. Hopefully the movie feels very loose and ramshackle, but the truth is that it's a very written movie and very specific, and we had such little time to make the movie that that's the only way it could have worked. Because I find that oftentimes there's these experimental indie projects where you watch the movie and you go, well, it looks like they had a really good time making the thing, but it's a little vague. It's a little sloppy.
Right.
And here, you know, somebody, of course, is entitled to their own opinion. They might feel that way, but it's all my fault. Like, it was definitely all in the script, and that's what we, you know, the actor simply made it much, much better than what was in the script, but it wasn't improvised. It was very deliberate what we were trying to do. So, yes, different approaches with different actors, but the main thing was these were all a group of actors who came in prepared, knew their dialogue. We did some rehearsal and then put two cameras on them, and with a very limited amount of setups, we had to cover big chunks of emotional stuff, too.
Right. And you probably answered part of this just now, but you had a 12-day shooting schedule. I know every filmmaker would love the luxury of more time and more money on any project, but is there a benefit to a rapid pace on a film such as this in any way?
Hugely. I mean, I find it. You know, I think 12 days is maybe a little extreme, but I find, you know, it's the old, you know, necessity being the mother of invention. It's, you know, if you're Francis Ford Coppola and you're doing The Godfather and you have 40 days and then you're doing, you know, a movie much later on and you have 100, there's no doubt that more choice and more freedom sometimes messes you up because I find that when you're making a movie, it's all the preparation you can have, you should take, but at the end of the day, it's all gut and it's all instinct. So so definitely doing something like this was not hurt by the short amount of time. Some of the locations could have been better, and we could have done some, you know, groovier shots and had some less shaky handheld camera where, you know, we were moving for speed instead of for style. But definitely from the acting standpoint, I think it was very helpful for the actors, for the actresses in particular, because they were doing these big emotional things that were not split into two or three days, that were all done in, you know, two, three takes that were, you know, 7 minutes long each. So that, I think, really comes across. And they really, you know, went to town with that because these are people who, you know, it's no secret that women don't get that much to do in mainstream Hollywood. So they're used to playing the good girl or the bad girl.
Right.
Here they got to show many different sides, even when they were supposed to be, quote unquote, the bad girl. So they really took that chance, and I think they did a beautiful job.
Oh, you can tell all of your cast, they just relish the opportunity, the beautiful performances in this. It's always interesting to me, the chemistry of the movie is yours, you've nurtured it, and then you set it off into the world, and I know you premiere at festivals. I believe you played South by Southwest.
Correct.
With this film. When you present it to an audience for the first time, this film, was there anything that surprised or particularly delighted you about their reaction to it or comments about it?
Well, first of all, it's always nerve-wracking. It's the worst thing when you have to first present it to an audience. Because all you see if you're watching it, if you're sadistic and you're actually watching it with them, is all you see are the disastrous decisions that you made throughout the entire thing. And the movie is about 18 hours long, and you can't believe it. I'd say the most surprising thing in a good way about this movie was, you know, working in Hollywood, you're so used to dealing with working by committee. And, you know, and that's very vilified, and I'm not going to talk about, you know, Hollywood versus independent movies, but what was very noticeable is when you have 100% control of what you're trying to do, wrong or right. It's in a beautiful way. You can set certain things up at the beginning of the story that then pay off later that don't have the fingerprints of five other people that maybe changed what you were trying to do. And it's really satisfying to see an audience catch that and go, oh, this is referring to that. And it's very simple, but it's very, you go, yes, it's a good reminder that the more personal you make something, the more universal it becomes. And with this movie, I mean, in every festival that it's played, but South by Southwest being the first one where it was a packed house and it was the first time that it was showing and a lot of the cast were there, it was so gratifying to see people laughing so hard that they couldn't hear the next line, but then when things turned serious, without any manipulative over-prompting, the audience just simply follow, no problem. You know, so it's this movie is a much easier movie to understand if you see it than if you see the poster or the preview, because you're like, well, is it campy or is it sexist or is it like just for chicks or do guys like it? It shouldn't be that tricky to explain it, but it is, because we don't have that many comedies that are like, look, it's technically a women's film, but that a guy won't hate. Like, it's okay for both. You know what I mean? It's like it's the anti-chick flick, you know, because we've gotten so much pap and so much annoying, you know, women's movies where at some point in the middle of the movie the chicks are going to be in their pajamas jumping up and down to a really bad song. You know, you're like, I don't want to see that. So it's been very satisfying to see it with an audience and have them follow it. Beautiful.
Oh, I bet that's really satisfying for you. Before I let you go, I just got to touch upon this. This is actually the first in what has evolved into a trilogy.
Correct.
For you?
Correct.
So where do we stand on the other two installments? Where are you with those?
Well, the second one has been shot, and I'm just finishing editing right now, and it's called Electra Lux, which is the porn star name character of the Carlo Gugino character. And it, you know, it picks up a couple months later, and it's yet another day in the life of, it's about half these characters and half new characters. And we had such a good time making the movie that I thought, you know, it'd be really cool to see, since we get such little snippets of some of these characters, it'd be interesting to see them in different situations. And I've always felt that, you know, novels can do that. And I'm always very jealous. You can have if you're the same author, you can have like a small character in this novel become a bigger character in the other novel. And I've always wanted to do that with movies. Like, I always felt like there's movies that I don't love, but I'm like, I'd love to take this Don Cheadle character from this movie and put him in this other story, but there's so many copyright nightmares that you can't do that. So I thought, well, I'll do it myself. So instead of trying to make the same movie three times, what if I just made a different kind of movie but grabbed some of the characters and, you know, and that's what it became. So Electra Lux is the second one, and obviously Carla's in it, and also Joe Gordon-Levitt has a much bigger part in that one, and Timothy Olyphant is in it, and he's really great in it, and Malin Ackerman. There's all these really cool people in it. And then there's a third one that takes place about a year later called Women in Ecstasy, and that we're supposed to shoot early next year.
Okay, Sebastian Gutierrez, the movie is Women in Trouble in limited release right now. So it's a trilogy, and he's already shot the next installment based on Carla's character.
Mm-hmm.
And then Women in Ecstasy is the third one.
Was he, like, you know, influenced by, because this is, like, I know for us, you know, in this country, we have all these great actresses, and we don't know what to do with them, sadly. There are a couple of, like, great independent directors, like this gentleman and others, who do know what to do with them. But sadly, on the mainstream level, we really don't. We don't have the faith of, like you know, something like a Francois Ozon or a Pedro Almodovar. The only one who's really doing it is Woody Allen. Even in his worst movies, the actresses shine. He can't help. He just
Actually, my understanding is that Almodovar is an influence for him, particularly.
I would think, because this sounds a lot like Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown and Talk to Her and several of his other films. You can't just reading about it the other day. I was like, wow, this guy really loves Pedro.
I will, however, I'll be first in line to see a movie called Women in Ecstasy.
Oh, dude, I'm there. I mean, I'm going to go ahead and buy my ticket from Fandango right now.
That's something I never get to see in my real life. So, okay. I watched Star Trek, Jerry.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, I'll be honest with you. It didn't surprise me you didn't like it. It really didn't. I don't know why.
What is your take on why I didn't like it?
Dude, you don't like science fiction or fantasy. You really, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I just never got that impression from you. That you really gave a shit about what happened in outer space. You're always much more down to earth. I know for a fact that you probably, you know, this whole new moon thing, well, for all of us probably, after in a certain demographic, really don't care, but it really just goes over your head, some of the fandom and everything. But I never, that you would say I didn't like Star Trek, if you said you liked it, I'd ruin my pants, okay? I didn't expect you to like Star Trek.
Okay, well.
Even though Jason O'Brien is waged the jihad against you.
Interestingly, I mean, New Moon is the Twilight series is kind of a different thing because I am not of the mindset of a 16-year-old girl, so I don't know.
Or a 45-year-old white woman.
Okay. But Star Trek is another thing that's lasted decades and decades, and I don't discredit the fans of Star Trek, of which there are numerous really fanatical fans.
Yeah.
That I've met and encountered and not quite befriended. Don't want to go there.
I just like what you said on the last show. If a person told me they like Paul Blart Mall Cop,
I'm not associating
out
with them.
That person.
That's right. I went to
that was so funny. I mean,
I went to a convention one time and Star Trek was big there and everybody was in their full costume and speaking the language of the Borg or whatever the hell it was. And it really, I knew that something deep was missing in their lives. But with Star Trek, I really don't like it. I kind of despise it. And even if the TV show is on, it actually gives me I automatically kind of feel nauseous. There's something irrational about my abhorrence of Star Trek in general.
Yeah. I like the original series because I grew up with that. I can't say after that I really cared much for it, but I like the original series. But like my mom's never was a big Trekkie, and she really liked this movie a lot. She thought this was incredibly well done. I mean, I don't think it's a great Star Trek movie. I just think it's a great film. Period.
That's what I was looking forward to. And I hear J.J. Abrams say, you know, I never liked Star Trek, and so that's why I took this movie, because I wanted to make a difference. I don't see how you cannot like Star Trek and like this movie, right? Because it's so ingrained in the mythology and the iconography of Star Trek.
It is ingrained, but it plays with it and disturbs some things. I mean, it's loyal to a fault, but then it goes off the rails and decides I'm going to have my way with this series, and I appreciate it for that. I kind of wish that the Star Wars prequel trilogies were this much more loose in the way they were made. I wish they were, because this is a really just, I thought, a well-made film, not just it was just a really incredibly well-made.
No, you're right.
It is
a well-made film. You're right, and that's what I'll give it. J.J. Abrams is extremely talented. It's an A-class production.
Have you gotten hate mail in the last 24 hours?
I've gotten like 40 messages of varying degrees of support.
Did Jason O'Brien like toilet paper your house or something?
He doesn't understand why I don't like it. But it's almost beyond the film. Mm-hmm. My resistance to it, because it's just a built-in resistance to anything Star Trek. And, you know, and I just groaned every time they had like a half a dozen meet cutes at the beginning of the movie where they say, oh, I'm Uhura, oh, I'm Bones, and there's supposed to be this, like this recognition in the audience, and they're, you know, it's a groaner for me.
Okay.
The action sequences are fine, but the villain is so weak, I wasn't invested at all in that plot. I think, you know, Eric Bana was a completely weak villain. The relationship between Kirk and Spock. What's that?
You think he was much more effective in Lucky You? Remember that movie?
Yes.
The Poker movie?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes, I do, actually.
Okay.
And I think he's an incredibly bland actor. I think he's like the acting equivalent of a rice cake. But,
there goes the Munich tribute show right down the tubes.
Yeah, they cast him. He was good in Munich, but they cast him to play like the Hulk, and I couldn't tell the difference between regular Eric Bana and angry Eric Bana. There was just
one note. Man, you're coming out with all guns blazing tonight. Oh my God.
Yeah, so the I did have problems with it. It wasn't all irrational. negativity for on
right.
my part.
Okay.
But they're talking about bringing back Khan for the next one.
Yeah, I don't know what, you know, I was kind of hoping they would avoid that, though, because then try to go off on a different, because they have, like, set it up, they can do whatever they want now. Because the
yeah.
way that, you know, and I was hoping that, and you don't want it to be, if you reboot it, that's fine, but if you're going to go back and just, like, remake everything, what was the point then? I mean...
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who would be brave enough to accept Khan. But even so, when they cast Khan in the person of Ricardo Montalban, who would have thought before seeing his performance that that would have been anything, really?
Well, he was great. Well, in the TV show, though. I mean, in the original.
Oh,
show,
was he? Oh, okay.
Yes. Here we go. Yeah. No, he was just incredible in that. No, he broke, you know, the claim to fame in that one is he broke a phaser in half. There's this big fight with Kirk and the... Yeah, no, that was a really good one, but you know, he was I can't imagine anyone else playing Khan. That's like a really
That is a good villain. That is a good
yeah.
villain. And I'm not so blind that I don't recognize the best films of the series. I mean, I recognize that the Even Numbers are the best films.
Right, right.
Like,
no, yeah.
Two and four.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it gave
so
the king.
All right, you didn't like it. I don't see Someone said Antonio Banderas would play Khan.
Wow,
that's it could work.
Maybe with subtitles.
Javier Bardem, then let's go with him.
That's right. He walk up to Kirk and say, "Call it, friendo." Yeah, it would be good.
It's a coin toss. Call it.
I also saw Drag Me to Hell, and I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wasn't over the moon by it, but it was exactly what I thought it would be or hoped it would be from Sam Raimi. It
right,
was
right.
An extreme, delirious, good time. It was, I laughed out loud several times.
Right.
Just by the nature of how far it went and how he could make a button or a handkerchief, instruments of horror.
Yeah.
That was brilliant.
No, it was. It was very good. It was everything that, like, Chris had talked about earlier. In the summer after he saw it. And, yeah, I mean, it's just a great time. No doubt about it.
Yeah. I would cast Matthew Broderick as Khan. How's that?
Oh, my God.
The only actor blander than Eric Bana.
Damn, man, where did Eric Bana get on? What, did he come over here? Did he turn us down for an interview?
Oh, he has in the past, yeah.
Oh, that's where this comes from. Okay, I just wanted to know. I mean, don't ever turn us down for an interview or Jamie will go medieval on you.
Yeah. Don't even get me started on Pacino.
Don't. That's still the holy grail. Don't go there.
I did see a good movie. I saw this movie, The Open Road, Jeff Bridges and Justin Timberlake.
You
this
saw that? Where did you see that?
It got mailed to me, but it's coming out.
It got mailed to you?
It came out on DVD.
It
came out on DVD yesterday.
Oh, okay, cool.
That gives you a sense of where the movie business is. You got a movie with Jeff Bridges and Justin Timberlake. It didn't get a theatrical. It got it straight to DVD.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. It's a good, solid, completely unsurprising film that rides entirely on the performance of Jeff Bridges.
Okay. I want to see it. I mean, I definitely want to check it out. And I want to check out Crazy Heart, which they're all talking now is...
Which, yes, which is the major Oscar contender for Best Actor all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And it's a testament to the quality of the performance in the film, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a testament to the marketing push because...
Oh, it's a big... They really... Fox Searchlight, I think, is putting everything into that one now because Amelia...
They weren't going to release it, yeah. Yeah.
Amelia fell, I mean... It's a beautiful-looking film. If you ever get a chance to see it, I can't say much more than that. I don't, you know, it's a bland film. You know, you talk about bland, and the sad thing about Amelia is you wouldn't expect it because of the director, Maya Mira, did Monsoon Wedding and The Namesake and several other great films. You wouldn't
yeah.
expect a conventional biopic from someone. You just wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
It would be the last. And it just is. I mean, it's really just, you know, paint-by-numbers filmmaking.
I got. I also watched *Serious Moonlight*, which is the movie the directorial debut of Cheryl Hines, who's an actress that we all know from *Curb Your Enthusiasm* and various other projects. And I was really delighted with it. And most of all because it comes from Adrienne Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
For those listeners that aren't aware, she was a great writer-director. Her last movie was Waitress a couple of years back, which was just such a positive, uplifting movie
mm-hmm.
for me, but never less than truthful. It didn't reach those highs easily.
No, it was a very well-done film. And let's not forget, Adrienne Shelley's really, what is the term I want to use here without, she's probably the most important independent or the most important actress since some of the French actresses that worked for Godard and Truffaut, because she's really Hal Hartley's muse in the first two films, The Unbelievable Truth and Trust. And, I mean, it's from her that we get Parker Posey. Every actress after that just has some of Adrienne in her. It's unavoidable. I don't care who you are, every Chloe Sevigny, Zoe Deschanel, all of them come from Adrienne Shelley.
There's an acerbic quality to her and also
mm-hmm.
something incredibly sweet. And
yeah.
that's reflected in her writing and in all of her characters. I mean,
yeah.
the beauty of when Carrie Russell gives birth
mm-hmm.
and she was resisting this baby.
Right.
And she didn't want it. And this was a reflection, I think, on Adrienne, too, at the time. And
yeah.
then she gives birth and all of a sudden her life becomes very clear.
Mm-hmm.
Contrast that with another really telling scene where she's tells her abusive boyfriend that she's pregnant with their
mm-hmm.
baby. And he starts to talk about, promise me you won't love the baby more than me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that made me angry.
Which is brutal, but
it is.
It's such a level of great perception and honesty about that kind of character.
Yeah,
about that kind of jealousy and that kind of possessiveness.
Well, before we do this interview, what is Serious Moonlight about for our listeners? What is the plot?
Serious Moonlight was Adrienne Shelley's script that she completed, and it was
mm-hmm.
to be her next project before her murder, which occurred right before Waitress premiered at Sundance, I believe,
right.
a couple of years ago. And it's about a married couple. The husband is leaving her for another woman. And Meg Ryan plays the wife, Timothy Hutton plays the husband. And she ties him up and holds him hostage and says, I'm not going to let you go until you remember why you fell in love with me and you agree to stay. In the middle of this, it's there's madcap comedy. It's kind of not a typical romance, but there's really emotional moments, and there's moments that are very uncomfortable and a little brutal. It has a lot of colors in it, and
mm-hmm.
like Waitress, it's ultimately very life-affirming and uplifting. Here's a trailer for it, and then we'll play our conversation. I don't want to play the wrong...
No, I understand.
I don't want to play the wrong clip again. I guess I should be better at labeling these. Here's a trailer for Serious Moonlight.
I threw heck to the wind and drove up to the country a day early.
I want you to hold all calls. Looks like I'm about to have a lot of sex.
Ian?
Sexy.
Yeah.
What's wrong?
Please sit down. I'm in love with someone else, Louise.
Who is she?
She's very pretty. Not so bright, though.
I'm so sorry.
I told him he had nothing to fear about coming clean with you. You should have done it a year ago.
Whoever said all's fair in love and war...
I'm going to Paris.
No, you're not going, Ian.
...didn't know Louise.
I'm very sorry.
Stop packing!
I've decided to keep you here until we can work this out. I'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
From the writer of Waitress.
I am going to play and sing you a song.
Please don't.
Comes a comedy about the good times.
None of the slides are from the last 10 years.
You need to make more slides.
No!
The bad times.
Do you remember the promise that you made? Nobody in my life would ever love me as much as you did.
You can't keep a person hostage until they love you.
Come on, Ian. I'm sure it's been done before.
Hey! Hey!
And the times.
Up here, help! Hey!
You should have locked the door.
If you shot him, I'm trying to rob you.
What?
Meg Ryan.
Do you remember this day? Like I do.
Timothy Hutton.
I do remember that day. You look so beautiful.
Kristen Bell.
Who are you?
And Justin Long.
Riley, you haven't needed me for years. You're a superwoman. You make more money than I do. You can fix anything.
You can bench press more than me.
All right, I don't need you. But I love you.
Serious Moonlight.
Oh, God, they take you to the toilet? No, I did that. What?
The film Serious Moonlight is in limited release this Friday, and it's currently available on video on demand. So we talked to Cheryl about the film, her first step behind the camera to direct the film, and we get in a couple of quick Curb Your Enthusiasm.
All right, questions. I've got to hear.
I couldn't resist.
I know.
Here's Cheryl Hines.
Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Cheryl. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm terrific. It's a great pleasure to be able to speak with you. I see you every week here in my home. You're projected into my TV and on my favorite television show, so this is a real honor for me. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Let me tell you that I really, really loved your movie.
Thank you.
I'm curious, was this going to be Adrian's next project?
It was going to be Adrian's next project. As a matter of fact, Michael Royce, who produced this and also produced Waitress and worked with her on Waitress, he said that she always talked about shooting Waitress and Serious Moonlight at the same time, like back to back. But they decided not to do that.
But you obviously share the sensibility that she had, so I would imagine that's why they entrusted you with her script.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because that was the idea. You know, I really appreciate Adrian's writing, and I loved what she did in Waitress, and it is a bit of a quirky tone. The way she writes is, or she wrote.
Well,
and quirky.
This has a lot of tonal similarities to Waitress. Mm-hmm. And Waitress was one of my very favorite movies the year it was released, too. And if I think about the characteristics, I mean, obviously it's very funny. It's truthful. It's uncompromising. Sometimes it's uncomfortable. But both of these films are so big-hearted.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted your take on her writing in terms of the male-female dynamic. What makes her writing unique in that respect?
I think she writes honest dialogue,
mm-hmm,
that couples would really say. And it's not, sometimes it's not pretty. Sometimes it's just raw and real, and you feel like you're watching two people actually talk. And I think that's the magic of her writing.
Yeah, yeah. So your first time out directing a feature film, it had to have been terrifying. But you're in the industry, and obviously you've worked with a lot of great directors. Did you seek anyone's advice?
I did, yeah. I sat down with Barry Sonnenfeld and tried to get a crash course in filmmaking from him. And I talked to Zach Penn, who directed me in The Grand. He was very helpful. Sometimes I would be texting him and asking him questions. And also Larry Charles I found to be very helpful. He was a spiritual guide for me, whether he knows it or not. I don't know if he knows it or not, but I should tell him that he was.
Well,
I would
he
ask
knows
him
it
questions
now. Yeah.
He knows it now, yeah. I would definitely be emailing him from time to time, asking him questions about it.
So when you're wearing the director's hat, for the first time, what did you learn about yourself in that role?
Well, I learned that I have a lot of stamina. I mean, for a girl that likes to complain when the temperature changes 2 degrees, going from that to, you know, working 16-hour days, it doesn't matter what the temperature is, rain, shine, mud, you name it, you're doing it, you're out there, you're living it, you're in the middle of it. I learned that I'm tough on the inside.
That's good.
I'm tougher than I thought I was.
But were you, when I'm looking at this movie, and it's a terrific movie, but in the back of my mind I thought this could just as easily be a stage play in a way. So when you're approaching it as a movie, was that a consideration for you to try to make it as cinematic as possible?
Yeah, of course, because it was written as a screenplay, you know, that's how I approached it. And it is challenging because it takes place in so few locations.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, not every movie is in Tahiti. Some movies are behind closed doors. That's
right.
What this was.
So when you read it, did you have pictures of who you wanted to cast right away? Did you see Meg Ryan as you read that role?
Well, it's interesting because first I read it just seeing Louise and Ian, just the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start the casting process, which is pretty fascinating. Very stressful, that casting process. But, you know, you sit down and you start talking to the producers, in this case, Michael and Andy, and talking about ideas and who you think would be great. And
and
we sent the script to Meg Ryan, and she really liked the script. And I just thought she would be so good in this film because I felt like she could bring a charm and a lightness to the character of Louise, who's
yeah.
pretty dark and is doing very bad things. And I knew that Meg would be able to do that and at the same time let the audience be on her side.
Right.
So
yeah,
it was exciting when she said yes to this film.
Yeah, that inherent likability is very important for a role like that.
Yes.
And she's got it. Let me ask you about the phase where you're done with it and you're showing it to audiences for the first time, the whole film festival circuit. I know that has to be very nervous-making for you, but was it completely satisfying? I would think it would be because this is a really uplifting movie.
I tell you, when we premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival
mm-hmm.
in front of 1,000 people, I thought I was going to pass out right before the film started. I have never been so anxious and nervous in my life. I didn't anticipate being so overwhelmed by the idea of 1,000 people watching my film, but
yeah.
I was. And then when you start hearing people laugh and you hear the whole theater gasp at the same time or laugh at the same time or clap during the movie, it was the most amazing feeling ever.
Yeah. I bet it is. And plus, because you live with it for so long, you might lose some kind of perspective in a way. So showing it to an audience of 1,000 that have never seen it before, it can make you see it in a brand new light. Is that
true?
That's
true. It is true. And it was very rewarding because it made me go back to all those hours in the editing room where you're creating a little moment, a subtle moment that I thought would be funny, but, you know, 8 months later, you're watching it going, I don't know if that's even close to funny. I don't even know if it's interesting. And then you watch it with a crowd of people, and everybody thinks that tiny moment is funny. It's just amazing,
wow.
Yeah.
Do you have the director bug now? Are you anxious to get back?
Well, I would like to direct another film. You know, it would have to be just the right project.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big commitment, huge commitment, the biggest commitment you can make in show business, I think. So it would have to be just the right one. But I feel like I've learned so much, and I'd like to use that in my next project. So
yeah.
It's kind of exciting to think about.
Let me just ask you one question about Curb,
mm-hmm.
because I would be remiss if I didn't. I think it's mm-hmm. the funniest show ever on TV, in the history of TV. And are you like us? Do you watch it every Sunday night just like the rest of us?
I do watch it every Sunday night. I mean, I could get copies ahead of time, but I don't. I like to watch it with my friends and see what the show is, you know, because the show is improvised.
Mm-hmm.
I have a story outline, but it's only, you know, 6-7 pages long. I don't know exactly what they've shot.
Yeah.
And I don't know until I watch the show, and I have such a good time watching Larry on Sunday night. I'm telling you. It's surreal because it's such a fun show to watch. I'll be watching it, then I come on the screen, I'm like, oh my God, that's right, I'm in this show.
Mm-hmm. Is there a favorite moment or an episode from this season that you like the most?
Well, it makes me laugh so hard when Larry is driving and he calls the guy in front of him a schmohawk. Because he says that's what his dad used to call people in traffic. And he said it was on last season, he talked about it. And then when he keeps bringing it up, and he's always so angry when he calls somebody a schmohawk. I don't know why, but it really gets to me.
I love you in the show, and I love your movie, and it's great.
Thank you.
It's great work, and I congratulate you very much on it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
All right, that's Cheryl Hines. The movie is Serious Moonlight, opening Friday in select cities, and it's now available on video on demand. I highly recommend it.
I'd like to see her direct Larry David.
Yeah.
That would be awesome, man.
You know, I would have asked that, but the thing about it is, nobody except Larry David, and Larry David doesn't even know it at this time, knows whether or not there'll be another season. You know,
Well, this is sort of an apocalyptic season in some ways. You got the last week's last Sunday's episode,
which was hysterical.
You knew they were doing that thing with Michael Richards. You just knew.
I applaud him for being daring and brave enough to engage.
That was very daring and very brave.
So he knows that, you know, this is a great concept he's had for this season, and this is how do you top it to make it specifically Larry David and Curb,
mm-hmm.
you know, so. Who knows? I think if a bolt of lightning hits him and he comes up with another great idea, he'll certainly
He needs to bring Woody Allen on next season. You know that, no, where they have to both be on screen at the same time.
As like his uncle or something.
Yeah.
He could be his uncle from Miami Beach or something.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
That would be funny. Okay, is there anything? Oh, Sunday, we're coming back. Sunday is November 22nd.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Mm.
Which is the 46th anniversary of the assassination of JFK.
Yeah, we've got quite a show for you.
Yes, we've got the editor of Oliver Stone's JFK, Joe
mm-hmm.
Hutching. So that'll be an interesting conversation. We've also got a director who's made a movie called Virtual JFK. His name is Kaji Masatani.
That sounds fascinating, too.
That's exactly what the movie is. It's very fascinating. It's a what if speculation.
I have a question for you.
Can I say what the what if speculation is?
Yes, of course.
How would the world be different had Kennedy lived? Mostly, would we be as engaged as we were in the Vietnam War?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Are we going to replay the interview with the director of Oswald's Ghost, I thought?
Oh, that's a great idea.
Okay. I'm always thinking.
Always thinking.
Always thinking. Not always the right things, but I am always thinking, though.
No, that's a great idea. We'll play
stuff. I was just thinking that the other day. I'd actually like to bring up something. I would be, you know, remiss if I didn't bring this up. I had incredible opportunity Saturday night to see a Finnish film at AFI before the Terry Gilliam film. I was invited by one of the actresses, Anna East Eden, who is actually of Finnish descent, but lives in Los Angeles, and she went back to Finland to make a movie called The House of Branching Love, which is sort of like divorce. You could say it's like divorce Finnish style. It's a very funny film. It's unlike any Finnish film, as they were talking about in the Q&A afterwards, because most Finnish films are downright depressing, and they're usually about World War II, as the lead actress made very clear in the Q&A afterwards. But it's directed by the older brother of, Aki Kaurismäki, who has made like films like Drifting Clouds, The Man Without a Past, Leningrad Cowboys, and those films, very cult films, but... You know, he's a very art house director, but this is his older brother, Mika. And this is actually a charming film, very funny. I really would be remiss if I didn't say anything about it, because it's just really, is really well done. If you like ensemble comedies, it's good. It has a lot of American traits. Everything sort of comes together at the end. There are a lot of different characters, a lot of interweaving storylines. But it's about a couple who are, you know, pretty much had it. They have a very unhappy marriage, and they're going through a divorce. And it's like, you could say it's like The Holiday, where the houses are the stars of the film. The house is the star of the film. They they live in separate parts of the house and everything. And it's a really entertaining film. If it ever comes around and gets a release, you should definitely check it out.
What's it called again?
The House of Branching Love.
The House of Branching Love.
And it's really good. Really good. I'll put the Toronto Film Festival article link in the chat room.
I've been watching Oprah lately.
Oprah's had the greatest week of any. She had Sarah Palin, Jenna Jameson, and the cast of Nine this week.
Yes. Yeah. And I've watched all three. I've gotten my bored housewife on and tuned in Oprah. But... today was interesting because, like you said, they have the cast of Nine, and I'm really looking forward to that movie.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
A musical?
A musical based on, though, one of the greatest films ever made, 8.5. So I can't, you know, I have no complaints there.
It all comes full circle because when it was revived, Nine, on the stage, it was the Guido was played by Antonio Banderas.
That's right.
Who has been brought up in our chat room tonight.
Yes, he has.
And Nine is obviously a musical, and our mystery movie song of this show is from a musical. How about that?
That's incredible. Small world.
And it won't be hard to figure out what the song is from or what the song is, but it's a good one. Last week we went obscure, so this week we're going not so obscure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Raul Julia played...
That's right, Raul Julia.
Yeah. You know what I always wanted to see on Broadway was Raul Julia playing Dracula. I always wanted to see that.
That would have been great.
What a dream.
That would have been incredible.
Fit, yeah. He was one of the greats. All right, we ready for our mystery movie song to close out the show?
Yes, we are.
Okay, we'll see you guys back here Sunday night. We got some interesting guests upcoming. One of which I'll throw it out there, possibly a woman by the name of Leslie Caron. Yes.
It got no reaction in the chat room.
Which, of course, we know who she is, right?
I know the name, but I don't know what she's from.
at American in Paris, Gigi.
Oh, my God, we're going to have her on?
Yes.
That's awesome.
Okay.
All right, cool. That's awesome. And is she have a new film or a
book? She just wrote an autobiography, so.
Oh, that's awesome, man.
Yeah,
dude,
yeah.
Talk about getting wider demographic. You can't, that's, oh, dude, this is great.
It's we'll start our own legend series. It'll be good.
Cool.
Okay, here's our movie song of the show. We'll see you guys back here Sunday night. A great show upcoming Sunday night. Jerry, I enjoyed it, man.
So did I.
Let's do it again.
Wait, let's do it again. All right.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.